enlightenment.
Yes.
Right?
Great.
And the first thing I want to work out are some basic questions about where this belongs in your thought process. So, should I just randomly call on someone? Oh, yes, I will. Okay, Miss Lumpscum, is this a defense? Is apportionment a defense? No, apportionment is not a defense, okay? So, we're studying it out of order, right? What does apportionment do? Bingo! So it tells you how much each defendant should pay. Excellent. So if you were analyzing a negligence case, when would you get to apportionment? What would you have to have shown to even be facing an apportionment question?
That there was more than
one. Bingo! So you can, you're only going to get to apportionment once you've done injury, duty, breach, causation, damages for defendant one, injury, duty, breach, causation, damages for number two, and then you're like, okay, and how do I divide it between them, right? So apportionment is sort of the last step, but we're doing it out of order because it matches so well with the defense we looked at last class, which was what? Which compares who has to pay what between who? Bingo. So comparative fault is a defense and it discounts plaintiff's recovery, right? Or bars plaintiff's recovery. So apportionment fits in here because it's also about assigning a percentage of liability between multiple defendants, okay? But it's not a defense. Everybody good? Good job, Ms. Lumpscum. You're off the hook. Okay. So why is it, next random person I'm harassing? Why is it that you probably never want to go see Dr. Harris or Dr. Rogatnik? Why are they on your list of not referred? What does the uncontroverted evidence show, Mr. Bibb?
Because they did 8 and 3 counts of medical malpractice and they couldn't diagnose her properly.
Right, so Dr. Rogatnik, the uncontroverted evidence, has 8 negligent acts of malpractice. And Dr. Harris, the pediatrician, after the child is born, has 3 more negligent acts, right? Okay, so what's the problem that the plaintiff faces in recovering from it? What is the no evidence of?
She can't prove exactly which one, what the cause of the injury was from which of the negligence committed.
Right. Can she show that they caused it, that they were both a cause?
Yes.
Correct. So she can prove that both their acts of negligence, both their breaches were a cause of injury, but she can't prove which caused what. So what nickname do we have for a fact pattern when you can't show what defendant caused what? What kind of injury is it? Indivisible injury. So we have multiple defendants and an indivisible injury. Okay, and yet we still have to try and prove who paid what. Okay, the first thing we need to know is what does the jury say when it says who was at fault and how many damages? So anyone want to fill that in for me? What does the jury say in terms of who was more at fault than someone else? We can't work out who caused what. Yeah.
They're giving $2,750,000.
$2.75 million. Okay. Did anyone notice how that later got discounted?
2.25.
Why does it go down to 2.25? There's a settlement, so some other defendant, most likely the hospital or someone, has already paid $500,000 in settlement, so they say, oh, the plaintiff's already got that, we'll take out the settlement number. So we're trying to work out who pays what. So what's the full allocation?
And then 80% to Dr.
Right, so when the jury looks at it, and you can see this looks to be more acts of negligence by Dr. Rogatnik than there is by Dr. Harris, so the jury says, we think 80% the fault is with Dr. Rogatnik and 20% is against Harris. And who's appealing here, saying, I don't like what I have to pay? Harris is appealing, right? So Harris is saying, I really don't like being on the hook. So, what system of apportionment is the court using? So what role of apportionment is the court using? What approach to apportionment? Yep.
Joint and several.
Joint and several. So the court's using the traditional form of allocation, which is joint and several, okay? Anyone tell me what joint and several holds?
When two or more tort feasors act concurrently or in concert and produce a single injury, they may be held jointly and severally liable.
So what does joint and several liability mean about what Dr. Harris has to pay?
Dr. Harris is arguing that he had no part of the brain, or the brain, it's the injury to the brain. But
right, the jury finds he does.
That because they act as one, they both cause injury, that he has partial liability.
Partial liability, or what does joint and several liability say you have to pay?
They both pay the whole.
They both are on the hook for the whole, right? So under joint and several liability, plaintiff can go after either one for the whole amount. Correct? Okay. Now, the trick, which is something you just mentioned, is common law didn't say everybody can get joint and several. See, joint and several is a very powerful weapon for the plaintiff. So, it's a trigger, right? There's a certain trigger you have to get through to get joint and several. You can't get joint and several as a plaintiff unless you prove this initial trigger. So, what trigger did you give me? Acting in concert, right? So acting in concert. Do you think the two doctors acted in concert? Let's get that baby. No, they didn't act, they didn't conspire, right? They don't act, hey, let's go, right? So we don't get, we can't get concert, right? So that trigger's not working. There was another trigger that the common law used to recognize. Another C, it's not as strong as acting in concert.
Concurrent.
And what would concurrent mean?
That they acted.
Concurrent, right? So the common law used to say, well, if they acted at the same immediate time, right, then we'll get joint and several. Okay? Were they both treating the child at the same time? No, why not? Rogatnik is what I picked. Yeah.
He was like the mother's doctor, like the OBGYN, and the Dr. Harris is the pediatrician who takes care of the baby after.
Bingo! So we don't have concurrent, right? It's not like that. So classic concurrent is two people in a drag race. They're both speeding down the road at the same time and they take you out. So we can't get through either of these traditional triggers. So the traditional trigger, the historic trigger, was that, okay? So we shouldn't be able to get to joint and several in this case unless the court recognizes another way to get to joint and several. So obviously they do, because neither of the other two triggers are met yet. So if you have a what? They say you can get to joint and several if you have an indivisible injury. Right? Multiple tortfeasors, indivisible injury will get you joint and several according to the court, even though you don't have either acting in concert or concurrent activity. They say we're also going to let you get to joint and several if you do indivisible injury. Good? And what do we have right here? Indivisible injury. So the court's going to apply joint and several liability. Miss Evans is not looking happy.
No, I just was wondering what the OR is.
Or.
Oh.
One or two. It's okay. That's what law school does to you, right? If you can have either of those. Correct? That's where most courts are. What is Dr. Harris's second dispute here? He says, I know. Okay, there's an indivisible injury. You're going to apply joint and several. But I think what? Yep.
That it should be put under successive and independent.
So one argument he has is, where's that going? Successive and independent is going to what?
It would be in place of successive, or sorry, in place of joint and several.
It's a description of what?
It should be separate.
So let's get rid of successive and independent. He was trying to characterize it as successive and independent. Why?
Because it takes place of concert.
There you go. So the old law used to say it's either concurrent or it's successive and independent. Right? So that was the opposite of this. So his first argument is you can't make me in this box because it's successive and independent. And the court says that's cute and nice. I don't care because indivisible injury is enough. Okay. So we got to indivisible injury. That's the trigger we're using. But he has another argument. What's his argument?
Because the trial jury apportioned his fault, then
bingo! Right? Excellent! He says, look, hey, jury said 20-80. It's not indivisible anymore. It's divisible. See the argument? Okay, and what does the court say in response to that? Why does the jury divide at 80-20? I mean, if we're in joint and several and each is liable for the whole amount, why are we asking the jury 80-20?
Just to kind of figure out the responsibility for each party.
Figure out the responsibility for each party, and what's the technical name called for the responsibility of each party? What is the 80-20 showing us? It's a step in apportionment. The plaintiff can get the whole amount from either one, so why do we need to know 80-20?
Contribution.
So the court says, look, all the 80-20 tells us is contribution. Right? What one defendant can ask of the other defendant in the fight between defendants. It doesn't apply to the plaintiff, right? The plaintiff gets joint and several, we cover the whole thing. All we're saying for 80-20 is contribution. What one defendant can pick up from the another defendant to make it fair between the two. Everybody good? So the court says that's not what the 80-20 tells us. It doesn't tell us how much the plaintiff gets. It tells us how to allocate fault between the two defendants. Are you good? Everybody good? Everybody happy with the case? Court says it's still indivisible injury, even though we have a fault allocation. Okay, are you guys ready to click? Do you think you can do it? 90%. Now you can advocate if you want. If you cite something in the book, it can't be random, like, believe me, I'm awesome. No, that's not advocacy. It has to be note something. Okay, so let's look at the traditional. The first part of the sheet discusses the traditional ways we apportion. So question, these are all based on our beloved doctors, our unbeloved doctors. So the first question is, Ravo versus Ragatnik and Harris, divisible injury. So it says, presume Dr. Rogatnik injures the right side of the child's brain and Dr. Harris injures the left side of the brain. Here's the statement. Dr. Harris is liable only for the damage for the left side of the brain. True or false? You can advocate or you can just get a flip. You can talk to friends. Oh, cookies are all up.
No, it's divisible, multiple divisible, multiple professors, divisible.
Speaking of
two people get, one person gets hit by two bicyclists, one breaks the arm, one breaks the foot. You can say who's responsible for what. Same thing here. Just can't remember what it's called.
But it's still divisible.
It's divisible. Your brain hemispheres are two separate parts.
Sometimes possible fake facts. So this is a little fake. I agree with you. Like, no, this doesn't really happen. But on my fact pattern, it did. Okay, you ready? It all end? No one. True at, oh, I think you're at 90%. They pushed the wrong button. 96%. They pushed the wrong button. Okay, so you saw this before, remember? Multiple causes of a divisible injury. What does the apportionment? What part of the negligence case did the apportionment? Injury, duty, breach, causation.
Injury.
I have an intellectual cause.
And you are correct. Right? Okay, so causation does the apportionment. One defendant causes right side of the brain injury. Other defendant causes the other side of the brain injury. So Bot 4 does apportionment. So you don't need a doctrine right at the end because causation, cause and fact, has done your apportionment for you. Good? Okay, so let's do the fact pattern that is presented by the case. Right? We're in joint and several apportionment system, the traditional apportionment system, and assume the doctors negligently cause an indivisible injury, right? Because they cause an indivisible injury, we can get to joint and several. And we're going to put the plaintiff's damages as $1 million because it just makes math so much easier. The jury determines that Rogatnik is 80% at fault and Harris is 20% at the fault. So the question number two is, Dr. Harris is liable only for 20% of the damages, $200,000. Is that true or false? So when the plaintiff sues, is Dr. Harris only liable for 20% of the damages or $200,000? So is it true that Dr. Harris is only liable for 20% of the damages? True or false? When the plaintiff sues, are we done? Now we're done. Hard luck. It is false. Correct. Because under joint and several, he is liable for?
Up to all of it.
The entire amount, right? That's why it's several, because you can go after either one for the full amount. Yeah. Up to the next question. I mean, that was brilliant, and we're going there. $1 million. He can seek payment of $800,000 from Dr. Rogatnik. True or false?
True.
There's only 24 of you.
On page 554, note 2.
It's okay, I click. Oh, 100%! You guys are rocking, man! Okay! What is this doctrine called? Contribution. Is contribution a tort?
No.
Right? It's not a tort. It's a remedy in restitution. That sounds like contracts. You done restitution contracts?
Yeah.
Right? Unfair. Let's fix it. Right? So restitution is a remedy claim, and torts recognize it right here. Okay, now you ask me your question.
Is he obligated to give his share to the other defendant? Like if plaintiff claims, you know, one from Dr. Harris or Dr. Redondo, for example, is Dr. Harris obligated to give that 20% to Dr. Redondo?
So if, no. So question number two, Dr. Harris has to turn around and actually file suit for contribution. So you're on the hook, the plaintiff picks to sue only you, only Dr. Harris. Dr. Harris gets hit up with a judgment for $1 million, he has to pay that judgment. If he wants to collect from Dr. Rogatnik, he has to make a claim. Now what note three told you is that you can actually file that claim in the same case, right, as a cross claim or as in pleader under Rule 14, which you will annex and ask with Professor Upchurch, and if you say you've never heard from it, I will know about it and I will come find you to kill you. Right? So the contribution claim you can bring as a cross claim in the existing lawsuit, or Dr. Harris could use in pleader to bring in this extra defendant. The old way, when you didn't have the modern rules of civil procedure, is it would be a second lawsuit. So it would be Rabo versus Harris. Harris pays the $1 million and then has a second lawsuit against Rogatnik to recover the amount. Modern procedural rules, we're like, okay, let's do it all at once. So we enable the defendant to bring it in that lawsuit. Yes?
In that cross claim for that second suit,
yeah,
he goes to get his payment after
right.
800. There's no defenses from that, correct? As long as the jury's apportionment is 80-20.
No, if you, especially if you see it as an in pleader or a cross claim, if you remember that the third party defendant can raise any and all defenses that the third party defendant has. So it depends whether it's post judgment. So if it's a separate second suit, then there's a judgment and you're just fighting about enforcing the judgment. If they're actually brought into the existing litigation, then they can file any defense that they have.
Yeah, but I'm saying, what would a defense be for him, for Dr. Burnett?
Rogatnik.
Saying that...
Well, it depends. If the judgment has been entered, you're stuck with the judgment because it's just a contribution claim. If it's a cross claim in that existing suit, then they can deny underlying liability.
So the original suit can say he was 80% at fault, and then the next suit or cross claim can say, too bad, we're not going to...
Wait, but you merged the two. If it's a second lawsuit, no, because there's a judgment. If it's in the same lawsuit, then Dr. Rogatnik can raise any defense he has.
Okay, and I'm just wondering, what defense would you use?
You can argue about the percentage because nothing has been determined. So you can claim, I'm not responsible at all.
Okay.
Right? You can dispute that claim.
Okay.
Yes.
Why is the title of the case Rabo versus Rogatnik when it's about Dr. Harris?
Because who did she sue?
Bingo.
And so when you shorten a case's name, if there are multiple yeah, look. It's okay. When you file a case, they'll shorten it. So the initial lawsuit, the initial summons will have everybody's names as plaintiff and everybody's names as defendants. When you go forward, you just pick up the first named party on either side. It's because we don't want a really long, long case title.
Yeah.
Okay, what else haven't we learned in law school? Good? Okay, it's actually a civil procedure question. It's under Rule 10B, which you'll study with Professor Upchurch next year, next semester. Yes?
So I'm sorry, I misunderstood. You're saying that you can dispute the amount in the second suit, or the second suit is basically just to get them in the
If they're actually two suits, so the old way of doing it, the plaintiff would recover the $1 million from Harris, this judgment entered, right? Then Harris goes to sue Rogatnik on restitution. And that, in that suit, you're not going to redetermine the underlying liability, right? You can fight about whether the court had jurisdiction, you can fight about a whole load of things. But what you see today is not the second lawsuit. You see Ravo versus Harris and Rogatnik, and there's a contribution cross-claim in the existing lawsuit. That was way more civil procedure than you need to know till the next semester. Okay, let us do wherever we were. Okay, if Dr. Rogatnik is insolvent, Dr. Harris must pay the entire $1 million. True or false? So suppose Dr. Rogatnik is insolvent, is Dr. Harris stuck with the entire $1 million? True or false? Are we happy?
No.
So under traditional joint and several with an indivisible injury, if Rogatnik is insolvent, Harris has to eat the whole $1 million. True or false? True is the correct answer. Okay? So joint and several advantages who? Plaintiff defendants.
Plaintiff.
Everybody see it? Plaintiff gets fully paid under joint and several. Okay. As number two, as part of tort reform, many states are messing with joint and several, because generally the tort reform is pro-defendant, not pro-plaintiff, right? And this is a pro-plaintiff rule. So under tort reform, many states change the rules. So we want to run the Ravo fact pattern in a proportionate system. And we want to run it under the Colorado statute on 557, right? So if you look, many states abandon joint and several liability by statute and instead go to what we're calling proportionate, right? They may not call it that, but that's what we're calling it. So the question is, if you look at the Colorado statute on 557, that's what we're going to apply. Question five. Dr. Harris is liable only for 20% of the damages. True or false? So if we are in Colorado and we are applying its proportionate liability statute, proportionate share liability statute set out on 557, question number five. Dr. Harris is liable only for 20% of the damages. True or false? We're looking at the Colorado statute. There's two statutes. We're looking at Colorado.
Yes. Look at the first paragraph.
100%. Got it right. You guys are awake. Okay, that is correct. What is exception number four? Under the Colorado statute, what would you have to show as a plaintiff to get back to joint and several? Bingo! You have to go back to those old, very limited in concert, right? Only if you're conspiring, Colorado says, to get joint and several. We're not going to give you joint and several just for an invisible injury. Good job, Mr. King. Okay, number six, true or false? If Dr. Rogatnik is insolvent, Dr. Harris must pay the entire $1 million alone. True or false? So suppose we're under the Colorado statute. Turns out Rogatnik is insolvent. Is it true or false that Dr. Harris must pay the entire $1 million alone?
They weren't working.
I'm waiting to see if anyone else is coming in. Full. Very good. Okay. Now, here you recognize the distinction. So consider answer 4 and answer 6. What happens if Rogatnik is insolvent? Who pays the 80% share of the insolvent Dr. Rogatnik and the joint and several who eats it? Right, co-defendant pays the 80%. So notice, if you're in joint and several, it's the co-defendant who pays the share that the missing defendant owed. If you're in proportionate share liability under these statutes, who pays the 80%? Plaintiff. Plaintiff eats the 80% for the missing defendants. Okay, which system is fairer? What do you think? I don't want to tell me they think. So if you were in the legislature and you're considering whether to adopt one of these proportionate share statutes, would you adopt it?
I guess for me it would be whether you believe the plaintiff as a victim should get the money or not, because otherwise it's fair to both sides. No defendant should pay more than what they attributed, but no plaintiff shouldn't get compensation for an injury.
Bingo. So that's the problem, right? Under joint and several, we like it because plaintiff is fully compensated, but we don't like it because
one person has to pay more than.
Right. And why does it seem particularly egregious that Dr. Harris has to pay? Right. He's the minor responsibility. Right. He's only 20% at fault, but he's getting hit for the whole thing. Okay? Or maybe it's only 5%, yet he still gets hit with the whole thing. But why don't we like proportionate share? Right. The plaintiff eats much of her recovery, even though, anyone remember this phrase? Innocent, guilty. Can you use that phrase from Battery? Between two innocents. Who should pay? Who's innocent and who's at fault? Who's at fault? Who's innocent? So that's plaintiff. And what could you say about Harris? He's negligent, right? Admittedly, it's so notice the disadvantage is that plaintiff, the innocent party under proportionate share, has to eat her recovery. When she's at least identified one negligent actor. Everybody see it? So proportionate doesn't look fair, because plaintiff has to eat it even though she's innocent and she's proved negligence against the defendant. Okay, how might you fix this? Yep?
Have a second part of the statute or another statute saying that if the difference is so much between the two percentages, then the other person with the lower percentage shouldn't have to pay.
And whose statute is that? The hybrid proportionate statute. New Jersey, bingo. So the last part of the clicker sheet is to use this awesome New Jersey statute. So see question number 7? We're using the New Jersey hybrid proportionate share statute. If Dr. Harris is liable, Dr. Harris is liable only for 20% of the damages. Is that true or false under New Jersey's statute? So under New Jersey's statute, is he liable for only 20% of the damages?
Yes.
Okay. And why is that true? Because?
He's less than 60%.
His fault is less than 60%, right? 60 or less percent, your liability is limited to your percentage. Okay, number 8. Under the New Jersey statute, Dr. Redgatnik is never liable for more than 80% of the damages. True or false?
False. He's over 60%.
Are we muttering if we finish muttering? Two weeks from now?
No.
Well, I won't hear you. I guess you'll still be muttering, but I won't hear you. Okay, it is false. Excellent job, right? Because he's over 60%, so he has to pay the whole thing. You might get cookies. Okay, so what, everybody see the policy goal of the New Jersey tort reform? What are they trying to achieve with this bi-level? So what's the policy goal that's motivating New Jersey to pass this proportional level? Yep.
That it's purely greater party percentage-wise, at least in more than 50 and 60 or more, then kind of right that you should be almost close to the same amount. If you're less than, you only pay what you
Bingo. So they're trying to protect those minor tortfeasors, limit their liability to their share, but if you're the major tortfeasor, they want to make the plaintiff whole, even if it means the defendant overpays. Okay, now I want to see if you're really lawyers. If you represent a defendant under the New Jersey statute, what is your goal?
Get them under 60%. There you go. How can you get them under 60%? We've argued this Bluth word. How? How would you likely drive down the percentage allocated to your defendant?
Bringing as many defendants and as many tortfeasors as possible.
There it is. The more defendants get pulled in, the more you drive your likely percentage down. See it? See the motivation? The motivation is add more defendants. They pick up a percentage. Maybe you'll get under the 60, and that will limit your liability. And that takes us to nightclub 35. Okay? Where is nightclub 35 decided? What statute are they applying? The one we just saw. Excellent. Hopefully that didn't just occur to you. Okay, so let's check the facts in this case. They're kind of memorable. It's kind of a, I'm not going there. Okay, so I want you to give me the facts. Am I just harassing someone randomly?
Random harassment?
Yes, Miss Craig.
Okay, so Club 35 is an adult club on the first floor and a club for 18 to 21 year olds on the second floor. And it employs bouncers for watching the dance floor for an ordinary type dancing. On January 9th, the plaintiff, his brother, and three friends went to Club 35 for the younger portion. Plaintiff was accused of pinching a girl and told to leave by a bouncer, yet thought it was meant to leave the vicinity of the girl, so continued to stay in the club and dance. The woman approached the plaintiff while on the dance floor. Strobe light went off, apparently. And then the plaintiff was punched in the face by one of the four men who approached him, and his nose was basically broken on the side of his face. And even though the bouncers had a clear view, none of them interceded before or after the assault and then offered assistance. The plaintiff was removed from the club and required surgery.
Okay, excellent. So who does the plaintiff name as defendant?
The defendant was the nightclub.
Is that the only defendant?
They were unnamed defendants for the bouncers.
Who else?
And then the people who approached him on the floor.
Excellent. Thank you. Okay, and notice, see, this is another bit of the law you pick up. Who's John Doe? Right, John Doe is just a fake name you write in, and then when you later find the real person, you actually serve them and make them a party, right? Anyone know what else you can call instead of Doe? You can say? It's not Jane Doe, it's Jane. Change the letter. Roe. Anyone know why the abortion decision is called Roe versus Wade?
Yeah.
His name, she sued anonymously, right? So that's why it's Roe v. Wade. Okay, let's simply do a little bit of review. What's the liability of Club 35? They didn't hit it.
They had a
duty to do what? Why? Excellent! Excellent! Everybody see? Against Club 35, he is an invitee. A landowner owes a duty to protect and warn, and they fail to do it. Correct. Excellent. So they owe the duty to use reasonable care to warn and protect, and refusing to even call emergency services, letting other people beat them up, just not a good job of warning and protecting. Okay. So that's not what the case is about, because we know they are liable. So what is the argument that we're dealing with here? What is the question the court has to deal with? Who does the defendant, what does the defendant want the court to do? Is that hard? Yes?
Lower the liability for the other negligent wrongdoers.
How does the club want to lower their liability? And so what do they want to get to?
Lower than 60%.
They want to get under 60%. And what is their strategy to try and get under 60%?
They want to include the unnamed persons in their saying that they were negligent.
Is it going to help them if the bouncers have a percentage?
No.
Because they're? Employee, so that just goes, so we get over and go, oh, give the bouncers a percentage. Who do they want to give a percentage? Okay, if you were faking, if you were the jury and you were told to assign a percentage, what percentage are you assigning to the assailant? Not what the court rules, but suppose we allowed you to give a percentage, right? Because the court says you can't give a percentage. But suppose we allowed you to give a percentage and you're the jury. When are you going to fix it?
You're going to at least give over 60 since he was the person that actually caused the assault.
Bingo! If you think, oh, well, whose fault was it, right? This looks like easily 60 plus, which means they're 40. You might even go 90-10. So see that strategy? If you can get an instruction that says the jury applies a percentage to the unnamed assailant, then you're limited to your percentage of the damages, 40%, 20%, whatever the jury picks. See the strategy? Okay, so there are two arguments as to why we shouldn't assign a percentage under the statute to John Doe. And the first one is usefully headed item number 2 on 559. So what's the first argument that the statute doesn't want us to assign a percentage to John Doe?
Actually, I have a question about that.
Okay.
If you do, for some reason they decide to do that, would you then tell the jury what would happen if you give them less, that the person wouldn't
recover 100%. So it's the same as we saw in comparative fault. Some states fully disclose to jurors everything. Like, okay, here's how proportional liability works. Other states don't, because they don't want the jury to fix the numbers. So it's that same dilemma which you will see state by state depending on their statutes. Good question. Okay?
So is that a judge instruction or a lawyer instruction?
No, well, the statute will tell the judge whether they're allowed to give that instruction. So if your jury instructions always work, but the lawyer asks the judge, Your Honor, we would like an instruction on this. And the judge will say yes or no. So the statute will tell the judge that they're allowed to tell the jury that. They're allowed to give that instruction. Okay, so what's the first argument, annoyingly headed to, on 559, as to why we can't assign a percentage to John Doe? Yep. He's an intentional actor, right? And what we were doing was assigning percentages to negligent defendants. And what does this court say? Can you assign a percentage to an intentional actor?
In the case they get?
Yes.
Did I say yes?
Yeah. So this state and most states today allow you to assign a percentage to an intentional actor. Right? Even though we think of this as comparative, as comparing negligence, most states to say, go ahead and assign a percentage even to an intentional actor. Okay, so then what's the second objection to assigning a percentage to this defendant? So we got through the first objection, you can't assign something to an intentional actor. Now we're on the second objection. Why can't we name a percentage to this defendant? They're special. Yep.
The court is treating it almost like it's defense. They're saying that the onus has to be on the defendant to bring in more parties because it will help them out. They're in a better position.
Okay, so that's the policy for the solution, but what's the problem? Yep. It's a fictitious person, right? It's a fictitious. Can you assign a percentage to a fictitious person, right? The defendant's like, hey, John Doe should take 80%. And we're like, who's John Doe, right? He's an unnamed party. He's not before. So can you assign a percentage to mystery person X, right?
Yes, you are.
Oh. In what? Oh, person. A person. Thank you. Okay, so see the objection? The objection is you can't assign a percentage to this fictitious person. Yep?
Can you just talk about the first one again? I don't understand.
So the first objection they have is you can't give a percentage to any intentional tort doer.
Right, and the court said you can.
The court says you can. Right, so the court says you may assign a percentage even though they're an intentional tort. And they cite the prior decision where they actually managed to identify the beater-upper, the five assailants. And the court says, yes, you can assign percentages to intentional torturers. So the reason it fails right here is because it's fictitious. So why does the court argue this result is correct? So I'm holding policy and I'm doing the first reason is in the statute. What do they point to in the statute that makes them think the New Jersey legislature does not want them to assign a percentage? Yep.
Because they look at the plain meaning of the statute first.
Okay. And what is the word to which they're giving plain meaning? So what's the word? They say we know what that word means. Yep.
Well, they say all parties to the suit.
And what does the word party mean? Why isn't John Doe a party?
It's fictitious.
Right, so who would be a party? What would you have to do to make a person a party?
Name him
and serve him, right, and summon him before the court. So once he's joined into the lawsuit, he's served, he's summoned, he's brought into the lawsuit, he is a party. So their first basis for their ruling is they look at the language of the statute, it says assign a percentage to a party.
they go, he's not a party. Okay? Then they offer policy reasons to justify it. Which is what you wanted to give me 10 minutes ago. What's the policy reason for reading it this way?
Because if it helps out the defendant should be the one responsible for collecting extra parties to the suit. The defendant is generally going to be in a better position to know who the unnamed party was.
So if the role was the other way, what would a defendant do? If the role was the other way that fictitious people counted, what would you do as a defendant?
Just name all sorts of fictitious people.
Yeah. Right, Jane Doe, John Doe, John Doe 15, Jane Doe 26, right? Because they just name all these fictitious people, right? And the court says, no, 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 no. We want to incentivize the defendant to do what? Actually name and bring in the parties before they pick up a percentage. And the last argument the court has is why it's particularly equitable on these facts. To say to Club 35, if you want to assign a percentage, you need to find them.
That they, the bouncers probably knew the people, and they didn't even name the bouncers that were involved in the situation.
There you go. So the Club 35, see how it's trying to play both sides of the game? They're like, we'd like to assign a percentage to this mystery person, and we won't tell you who they are. And the court says, no, if you want a percentage, you name them so the plaintiff can collect. If you don't name them, then you have to bear the whole burden. Okay. As the notes tell you, these statutes are highly individualized. In other words, a different statute could come to a different result on whether intentional counted, on whether a party counted, okay? So what we're doing in this area is we're looking at the statute and seeing what the statute says. So we see, have to go back to the language of the statute and see who it tells you to assign a percentage to. When you study remedies, and if you take remedies in the third year, you will find that this is an incredibly complex area. So there are massive fights about what to do with a defendant who settles. Right? Do you assign a percentage to a settling defendant? And what happens if they settle for less than the jury thinks their percentage is? Right? Okay, so it's a massively complex area, which if you take remedies, you will look at. We just need the ability to read these basic statutes. Any questions? Yep?
Why wouldn't they need? Because
I was just going to say, to be honest, they probably know who it is. With he's got juice, he probably said something like, "You need me, I'm going to come after you and kill you."
So that's one theory. Who else could he be?
He's one of the bouncers. He's an employee. So as soon as they name the assailant, they're liable. It's not a duty to protect. They act as their employee. So that's my best guess. If all the bouncers knew him, then my guess is he's an off-duty bouncer. So he's arguably an employee.